The secret of success in the music business is no different from that in any other business. Intelligent planning and hard work. Promises of shortcuts usually don't come through. Who does the work? Ask exactly who is going to be involved in your day-to-day work. It may not be the person you're meeting with. This isn't necessarily bad, but you should be aware of it from the start, and you should meet the people who will be involved. All professionals use staff people, some to a greater degree than others. In some firms, the staff people divide and multiply like paramecia, so the people you're meeting today may be gone in 6 months. Other places are more stable, so ask, and also ask your references. Fees. Never hesitate to ask what someone is going to charge you. I know it's an uncomfortable subject, but bring it up anyway. You can be in for a seriously rude surprise if you don't. And when you do raise the topic, be wary of someone who gives you a vague answer. If you really can't stomach a fee discussion, have another team member do it for you. Personality. It's a myth to think any one personality style is more effective than any other, assuming you don't hire a wimp. Screamers and table pounders, if they're smart and knowledgeable, can get a lot out of a deal, but no more than those who speak quietly, if they're smart and knowledgeable. Some people work with a foil and some with a saber. Both styles can be effective. Remember, you're hiring people to guide your professional life, not to hang out on the tour bus. It's nice if you strike up a friendship with your professionals, but it's not essential. However, with your personal manager, I think you need at least a solid rapport, if not a true friendship. I'm not suggesting you hire someone you really dislike, or someone who has the personality of a salamander, but I am saying these folks don't have to be your pals. In fact, some amount of distance is often helpful. Just as doctors can't operate on their own relatives, one of the main things a professional does is bring some objectivity to your life. There is a wonderful story about Genghis Khan, the great warrior. In the midst of a pivotal battle for his empire, involving thousands of troops on both sides, an aide went into Khan's tent and was surprised to find Khan himself sitting there. The aide said, "How can you be in your tent? The battle is at a critical point and the troops need your command." Khan replied, "I found myself getting angry over a turn in the battle, and I can't think straight when I'm angry. I came in here to cool off before deciding the next move." Think about that. If even old Genghis had to detach from his emotions to do the best job, who are you and I to do any better? When I have legal problems, I hire a lawyer. This may sound strange to you, but I get emotional about my own problems, and I don't trust my judgment when I'm too close to the situation. So I hire someone who isn't. In sum, a bit of distance from your professionals is not a concern, but you should feel comfortable enough to have an easy communication with your team. If you think you'll dread talking to one of them, look for someone else. Decide now, confirm later. Make a decision reasonably quickly, but confirm it slowly. In other words, once you've hired somebody, continue to watch them carefully, to the extent you can stand to do it. The fact that someone came in with rave reviews doesn't mean they'll be right for you, so consider them on probation until you've seen enough to merit your trust. And don't just take another team member's word that it's working. Force yourself to follow their moves in the beginning, and you'll earn the right to relax later. Remember, no one pays as good attention to your business as you do. Changing a team member. Here's what to do if something goes wrong on your team. Even if they never pay much attention to business, I've never met an artist who doesn't have a built-in radar that tells them when something is wrong. So if you're feeling weird, then, "Houston, we have a problem." It may be that things aren't being handled right, or maybe you just don't feel comfortable talking to one of the team members. Ignoring the issue doesn't help any more than turning on the car radio to drown out a rattle in the engine. It's like a quote I once heard attributed to Dick Gregory. "I read so much about the bad effects of smoking that I got scared and gave up reading." So, deal with problems head on. Talk about your problems. I know confrontation is difficult. I have never known an artist, or anyone else for that matter, other than a few ornery jerks who've been divorced 5 times, who enjoys confrontation. But for your team members to do an effective job, you must have an open communication with them. If you can't bring yourself to talk directly to the person who is bugging you, talk to another team member and make sure they carry the message. Fast. Nothing is worse than letting small things snowball to the point that they build into a major drama. If you discuss them when they're small, they can usually stay small. Often they're just innocent misunderstandings. If you talk frankly about your problems and they still aren't getting solved, make a change. No one has the right to expect a lifetime contract with you. People and circumstances change over the years. Those who were spectacular for you at one point in your life may no longer be interested in you. For example, if they've lost interest in their job or your career has taken a nosedive, etc. Or they may no longer be capable of handling you. For example, they were unable to grow with you and your career is soaring. Or you've changed careers and their expertise is in the wrong area, etc. I respect and admire loyalty, but blind loyalty does no one a favor. To me, loyalty means you don't turn your head and run off with every pretty face that walks by. And as you get more successful, pretty faces come out of the woodwork to try to seduce you, literally and figuratively. But loyalty is a two-way street, meaning you're entitled to the same commitment from your professionals. You're only obligated to stick with someone as long as they're doing a good job for you. If you're not getting the service you want, then loyalty means you discuss it with them and tell them what needs to be changed. Again, if you don't want to do it directly, do it through another team member. If things still aren't being done right, and you're sure your complaints were clearly communicated, make a change. But do it for the right reasons, not the wrong ones. Lost confidence. It pains me a bit to give you this next piece of advice, but you should have it. Once you've lost confidence in someone, it's almost impossible to continue with them. It's like falling out of love. It isn't easy to fall in again. I say this sadly, because many times we lose confidence in people for the wrong reasons. It may be that someone with a political axe has buried them unjustly. It may be that they're doing a terrific job, but they have the personality of a stop sign and treat you rudely or bore you to death. It may be they have just delivered bad news to you. Firing such a person is known as shooting the messenger, from ancient Greek times, when a messenger bringing bad news was killed. It may be they've done a terrific job on everything important in your life, but screwed up paying your bills 1 month, so you have no electricity and your spouse refuses ever to see their face again. Or it just may be an uneasy feeling in your stomach that you don't trust them. When you find yourself in this situation, again, I urge you to talk to the person openly, directly or through another team member, and tell them how you feel. I know this is easy for me to say, and I admit it's difficult for me to do as well. But I force myself, and most of the time I find that the problem is a simple mistake that's easily fixed. And even if it isn't, I always feel better just from processing it. If you talk things out, and the situation doesn't get any better, split. Cocktail party talk. Let me say a word about cocktail party talk. In college, we used to play a kind of poker called Roll Your Own. In this game, you get 5 cards, then draw additional cards, like in regular 5-card draw. Finally, you arrange your cards in any order you want before flipping them over one at a time and betting on each card. After flipping the first 3 cards, everybody at the table looks like they have a spectacular hand. There appear to be straights, flushes, straight flushes, 3 of a kind, high pairs, and every other imaginable configuration to make you want to drop out and give up the pot. However, when it comes to flipping over the last couple of cards, most of the hands are mediocre. I've always thought cocktail party talk is the same as flipping only the first 3 cards. Everybody sounds like a genius. Everyone has just pulled off the greatest deal since the Louisiana Purchase. The truth, however, is in the last 2 cards, which you never see. The $1 million deal turns out to be a $100,000 deal, with the other $900,000 being there only if the artist achieves massive success. Not that a $100,000 isn't a decent amount of money, but it ain't a million. Nobody talks about their screw-ups, because self-aggrandizement is part of the Hollywood dance of the sand crabs. The whole point of this is to say that you shouldn't take casual talk at face value, especially if someone has an editorial point of view, like a manager trying to convince you to leave your current manager for the terrific things he or she can do for you. Lawyers, of course, would never do such a thing. And if you buy that, I have some land in Florida that would be perfect for you. So make your own evaluations in the realistic light of day. Chapter 3. Personal Managers. Role. The personal manager is the single most important person in your professional life. A good personal manager can expand your career to its maximum potential, and a bad one can rocket you into oblivion. When the job is done properly, a personal manager is the general manager and chief operating officer of your enterprise. There are, of course, some artists without managers, but they are very much the exception, and they usually have one or more other team members filling this role. The most important aspects of the manager's job are 1. Helping you with major business decisions, such as deciding whether to do a record deal, and if so, which record company to sign with. Deciding whether to make a publishing deal. We'll talk about what those are in Chapter 16. Figuring out how much to ask for, etc. 2. Helping you with the creative process, such as deciding which songs to record, selecting a producer. We'll talk about who producers are in Chapter 11. Hiring band members, selecting photographers, etc. 3. Promoting your career by managing social media, coordinating your marketing and publicity, and otherwise hyping you to everyone the manager meets. 4. Assembling your professional team by introducing you to lawyers, business managers, and agents, and overseeing these people's work. 5. Coordinating your concert tours by working with your agent to make the best deals with promoters, routing the tour, working with your business manager to develop a budget, assembling your road crew, supervising the tour personnel to make sure everything runs smoothly, etc. 6. Pounding your record company to maximize the advertising and marketing campaigns for your record, making sure your records are treated as priorities, screaming at them when they do wrong, praising them when they do right, etc. 7. Generally being a buffer between you and the outside world, such as fielding inquiries for commercial endorsements, personal appearances, charitable requests, both for money and for your smiling face, taking the rap for tough decisions that you make but don't want anyone to think you did, etc. Let's first take a look at the structure of your deal with the personal manager, and then we'll talk about picking one. Commission overview. Managers typically get from 15% to 20% of earnings from new artists. Established artists can sometimes knock them lower, as we'll discuss in a minute. These percentages are generally applied to your gross earnings, meaning your earnings before deducting any expenses. That means, 1. If you're an individual artist, the fee is pretty much what it sounds like for songwriting, publishing, records, etc. We'll discuss some of the finer points later, but basically, if the manager's deal is 15%, they get 15% of what you take home. However, when it comes to touring, the 15% means much more than you might think. You'll learn when we discuss concert appearances in Chapter 23 that you're lucky to take home 40% to 50% of your gross income. That means a manager's 15% of gross can take a big bite out of your net. For example, if you earn $100,000 and net $45,000, your manager gets 15% of gross, $15,000. Since you're only taking home $45,000, the manager's 15% is one-third of your money. Not so good if you're the artist, though awesome if you're the manager. 2. If you're a group and you have more than 5 members, 15% of gross equals almost the same as or more than any one of you earns, assuming you're dividing equally. For example, if there are 7 of you, everybody gets 1/7. That's 14.28%, which is less than the manager's 15%. In fact, since the manager's percentage comes off the top before you divide up any monies, you only get 1/7 of the 85% left after the manager's 15%, which is 12.14%. And for touring monies, a manager's 15% of gross can be many times your individual share of net. Because artists have found it, shall we say, uncomfortable to pay managers more than the artist makes, the classic 15% to 20% of gross has softened over the last few years. Here's what's going down. Negotiating the manager's deal. Despite the powerful personality of many managers, carefully designed to keep you in your place, it is possible to negotiate with your manager. However, just like any other negotiation, the result depends on bargaining power. If you're a major artist, bringing in $10 million plus per year, the managers will follow you like floppy-eared puppies, delighted to take whatever treats you care to drop in front of them. On the other hand, if you're a brand new band negotiating with a powerful manager, you're the doggy. Here are the points to discuss. Compensation. The first and most obvious issue is the manager's percentage. You should try to limit the percentage to 15%, although some managers argue that the risk of taking on a new band is worth 20%. They say it will be years, if ever, before they get paid for a lot of work, which is true. A compromise is to say the manager gets 15%, but it escalates up to 20% when you earn a certain dollar amount, such as 15% of the first $2 million and 20% of the excess. I've also seen the opposite, where the manager gets 20% up to a certain level and then 15% after that. The theory is that the manager gets a bigger percentage when you're young and the manager can't make as much, but his or her cut drops to the 15% norm when you're successful. This seems a bit weird at first, because it looks like the manager has no incentive to make you more successful. The more success, the lower the managers take. But that's not really true. All managers would rather have 15% of a big number than 20% of a small one. This kind of deal is much better for you with success, though of course it's worse if you flame out. Sometimes managers share on the net of an artist's earnings, meaning your earnings after deducting expenses, rather than the gross. This is way better for the artist. For starters, the manager won't get paid if the artist loses money, which is not the case in gross deals. In one deal I'm aware of, the manager got 20% of the net of a 4-piece band. Another deal paid the manager on the gross for records and publishing, but on the net for touring. When a manager has a deal on the net, they will often ask for limits on the expenses. For example, artists who decide to go on the road and charter jets, throw parties in every city, put inflatable pools in their hotel suites, etc., can easily eat up the net while having a great time with their pals. Managers don't enjoy these parties quite as much. Thus, the agreement might be that the manager is paid on net touring proceeds, but that the expenses of the tour can't exceed a negotiated percentage of the gross, or that the manager has the right to approve expenses, which I don't love as much, because you could often end up fighting with your manager about expenses. A variation on this theme is that the manager gets a percentage of gross for touring, but the commission is capped at 50% of the net. In other words, the manager will never make more than the artist actually puts in his or her pocket. For example, if your gross is $1,000 and you have $800 in expenses, your net is $200. If the manager got 15% of the gross, he or she would earn $150. Under this arrangement, the maximum would be 50% of the net, 50% of $200, or $100. So the manager gets $100 and the artist gets $100. Note, however, that if you're a group, you all have to share the artist's 50% of the net, which means the manager makes more than any one of you. In a few situations where the artist is a superstar, the manager sometimes gets 10% or less, and occasionally just a salary, no percentage. These salaries can run well into six or sometimes even seven figures. You could also try to reduce the manager's commission for endorsement earnings, meaning money you get to hype a product, and for film and TV appearances. The argument is that you have to pay an agent to bring you these opportunities. More about agents in Chapter 6. Meaning, you're paying two people for the same gig. If the manager won't reduce their commission, you can sometimes get them to agree they'll only commission the amount left after you pay your agent for those deals. For example, if an agent brings you an endorsement deal for $100,000 and the agent charges 10%, the manager would get 15% of $90,000, $100,000 less the agent's $10,000. If the manager agrees to this, they'll want to cap how much you can deduct for the agent, usually 10%. Exclusions. It's sometimes possible to reduce or even exclude certain types of earnings. For example, if you're a major songwriter who's hiring a manager to help you become a recording artist, the manager might get 15% of your earnings as an artist, but only 10%, or even 7.5%, 5%, or 0% of your songwriting monies. Or maybe the manager gets 15% of your songwriting monies from records on which you appear as an artist, and a reduced or no percentage on other songwriter earnings. Another example is an established motion picture actor who hires a manager to help with his or her music career. In these cases, you normally exclude or reduce the percentage for the area where you're already established. If you exclude any of your earnings from commission, the manager won't be obligated to do any work in the excluded area, though they often do as a practical matter. Money-losing tours. You can sometimes get managers to agree that if a tour loses money, they'll take no commission on it. This is the same concept we discussed earlier when we talked about capping your manager's commissions at 50% of your touring profits. If you can't get your manager down to zero on money-losing tours, then try for a reduced commission, meaning, for example, instead of 15%, they'd only get 7.5% on a losing tour. And at the very least, get them to defer their commission until you're more successful, meaning you agree they're entitled to a commission, but they have to wait and get paid later, when you have money coming in. Another variation is that the manager doesn't get paid for dates where you make a small amount, such as $1,000 per night, or a similar negotiated figure. Repayable monies. Sometimes you have to pay back money you get under a deal, for example, under some merchandising deals, as we'll discuss in Chapter 24. In this case, ask the manager to repay their commission on monies you have to shell out. Deductions. Certain monies are customarily deducted before computing the manager's percentage, even when a manager is paid on gross. Most managers don't take commissions on these, even if their contract says they can, but some try. So it's always a good idea to spell things out and avoid any misunderstandings. Here's the list of no-nos. 1. Recording costs. If the record company pays you money and you spend it on recording costs, you shouldn't pay a commission on those monies. This is because the funds only pass through your hands, i.e., you don't keep them, and so they aren't really earnings. 2. Monies paid to a producer of your records. Producers are the people hired to put together your recording, as we'll discuss in detail in Chapter 11, and you pay them advances and royalties. Just like recording costs, monies you have to fork over to a producer aren't really earnings, for the same reason we just discussed in connection with recording costs. 3. Co-writers. When you write songs with somebody else, the manager shouldn't get paid on the other person's share of the song's earnings, even if you collect them first. 4. tour support. This is money paid by a record company to offset your losses from touring. Refer to Chapter 13. Whether managers should commission tour support is a bit controversial. Some managers argue this is money you get from the record company, just like any other money, and they helped you get it, so they should commission it. Most of the time, however, they'll agree it isn't commissionable, because it only compensates you for a loss. 5. Costs of collection. If you have to sue someone to get paid, the cost of suing them to collect the money, called collection costs, should be deducted before applying the manager's percentage. For example, if a concert promoter stiffs you for $50,000 and it costs you $10,000 in legal fees and court costs to collect, the manager should only commission $40,000, the $50,000 recovery less the $10,000 collection costs. Another way to look at this is to say the manager bears his or her proportionate share of the collection costs. 6. Sound and lights. It's common in personal appearance contracts for the artist to supply his or her own sound system and stage lighting. The promoter then rents the sound and lights from the artist for a specified dollar amount. Customarily, this rent money is considered an expense reimbursement, as opposed to a fee paid to the artist. So the manager isn't paid on the amount allocated to sound and lights. But you gotta ask for this one. 7. Opening acts. When you get to the superstar category, your deal for a personal appearance may also include monies you pay to an opening act. Again, since this money just passes through your hands, it shouldn't be commissionable. 8. Related entities. More and more often, managers now own record labels, and sometimes publishing companies, film production companies, concert promotion businesses, or even festivals. If you make a deal with a company owned by the manager, you shouldn't pay a management commission on the earnings from that company. Managers don't always agree to this, arguing that they're wearing two hats, for example, manager and record label, and therefore they should be paid for both. They also say, if you had another record company, you'd be paying them on the record company earnings. In response, you argue that they can't be expected to beat up their own company the way they would beat up a major label. You also argue that they're getting paid much more through that entity than they would as a manager, so they shouldn't double dip and get paid twice on the same earnings. They'd get paid once as a label when you sell records, then again as a manager when you get paid for those sales. Also, if you leave them as a manager, they'll still get paid as your record company if that deal continues. Term. The term of a management agreement, meaning the period of time that the manager will work for you, is usually 3 to 5 years. If you're an artist, you want to make it as short as possible. If you're a manager, you want it as long as possible. Historically, most managers tied the term of their deals to album cycles, meaning the time from when you start recording an album through the end of touring and promotion of that album. And some managers still operate on this basis. However, the concept of an album is challenged in the streaming world because artists release more and more of their recordings in non-album bunches, both bigger and smaller than albums, and the recordings aren't always at the same time. So the definition of an album cycle is becoming problematic, and the trend is now to set the term of a management agreement as a specific number of years. Be very careful when negotiating the term of a management deal. Many artists have lived to regret being tangled up in long-term contracts with lousy managers. Yet there's a balancing act that has to work for both sides. Managers don't want to put their sweat into launching your career only to see you waltz off at the first sign of success. And you don't want to be married to a moron who's holding you back. The most common compromise is to say that if the artist doesn't earn a minimum amount, he or she can terminate the agreement early. For example, the deal might be for 4 or 5 years, but if the artist doesn't earn $200,000 over the first 2 years, he or she can terminate the deal. I hesitate to give you specific dollar figures for the earnings because, one, they'll probably be out of date by the time you listen to this, and, two, they also depend on who you are. If you're a heavy touring band, the numbers are much higher than if you sing folk songs in coffee houses. But here's an example from a beginning pop artist's contract. The deal was for 2 years, and the manager could renew for an additional 2 years if the artist earned $300,000 over the first two. The manager could then renew for another third 2 years if during the second 2 years the artist earned $500,000. The manager, if he or she has any sophistication, will also say that the earnings have to include offers you turn down. The theory is that you can't refuse to work and then get out of the deal because you didn't earn enough. I usually agree to this, but require that the offers must be similar to those you have previously accepted. So an offer to appear nude at the Moscow Circus wouldn't count, unless that's your act. Another approach is to say you must have a record deal or a publishing deal if you're a songwriter within a year or 18 months after the start of the term, and if not, you can terminate the deal. If you get this kind of provision, you should also provide that if the record or publishing deal ends, the manager has to get another one within that same time period, 12 to 18 months. If you don't have this second provision, you could get a deal in the beginning, never make a record, get dropped by the label, and be stuck with the manager for the balance of their term. Termination for failing to clear the hurdle can be done two ways. One is a letter from the artist to the manager containing legal words that translate as, "You're fired." The other is a shorter management deal that gets renewed if the artist achieves certain earnings. For example, the term of the agreement is 2 years, but if the artist earns at least $200,000, the manager continues for an additional 2 years. The only difference between these two arrangements is whether the artist has to remember to send the manager a notice. Earnings after the term. The gift that keeps on taking. One of the most important points you have to negotiate is what your manager gets paid after the end of the management deal. Even though the term may end after a few years, virtually every management contract says the manager gets paid on earnings after the term if those earnings are generated under contracts entered into or substantially negotiated during the term. This language means two things. One, as to records made during the term of the management deal, the manager gets a commission from income earned by those records after the end of the management deal. And two, the manager is paid on records made after the term of your management deal if the records are recorded under a contract signed during the term. All of this could mean, and I've seen it happen, that a manager is still getting paid 7, 10 or more years after he or she finished rendering services. For example, suppose 6 months before the end of the management deal, you sign a 5-album deal. Under this clause, the manager gets paid forever on sales of these 5 albums, most of which will be recorded after you've parted company. I think this clause is way overreaching, and these days, most every manager will agree to cut it back. Let's take a closer look. The major things to worry about are records and publishing. Unless you're in a television series, long-term product endorsement deal, or some other non-musical commitment that could run for several years, records and publishing are the only areas where you're likely to have significant earnings from activities after the term under agreements made during the term. The other contracts you make during the term, such as personal appearance engagements, may be completed after the term, but this happens in a relatively short period, although it can represent millions of dollars. But if a manager is involved in setting up a tour, it's not unreasonable for him or her to be paid something for the tour, at least for dates happening within 6 to 12 months after the term. So if you're going to dump your manager, do it before the tour gets set up. Sunset clauses. Here are some of my better strategies to cut this back. These are known as sunset clauses because they end the day for commissions. 1. Records. A. The manager gets paid only on records recorded and released during the term, and not on any others. This is the best for you. B. If A doesn't work, a compromise is to pay the manager for records that are recorded during the term and released within 3 to 6 months after the term ends. If they're released later than that, the manager doesn't get any commission on their earnings. C. Another solution is that the manager gets a half commission. For example, if the manager has 15%, it's reduced to 7.5% on records recorded during the term but released afterward. The theory is that the manager only does half the work, overseeing the recording, but not overseeing the release and promotion. As in A, records made after the term aren't commissionable at all. 2. Publishing. A. The manager is paid only on songs recorded and exploited during the term. This is the best for you. B. The manager gets a half commission on songs recorded during the term and exploited after. C. The manager gets a half commission on songs written during the term but recorded afterward. This at least cuts off participation in songs written after the term under contracts made during the term. 3. Post-term reductions. You can often reduce the commissions while you're waiting for them to die. For example, there might be a full commission for the first 2 years after the term, a half commission for the next 3 years, then over and out. 4. Final cutoff. I try to have some date after which all commissions end, no matter what. Try 3 to 5 years after the term. Settle for no more than 7. Feel free to creatively mix and match the above 3 approaches. For example, the manager could get a full commission on records recorded and released during the term, but only for a period of 3 years after the term. Or they might get a commission for a period after the term equal to the term itself. For example, if the term were 3 years, the period afterward would be 3 years. If it were 4 years, the period would be 4 years, etc. And thereafter, nothing else. If it's a period equal to the term, you should ask for a cap, meaning a maximum number of years, no matter how long the term is, of, say, 5 years. If the manager agrees, they'll also want a floor, meaning a minimum number of years, such as 2. The limits are only your imagination and a manager's patience. A particularly thorny problem, and another reason you should pay so much attention to the commissions after the term, is the fact that after the term, you'll need to hire a new manager. As you can imagine, there aren't too many managers who want to work for free, and there are even fewer artists who want to pay 15% of their gross to 2 managers, 30%. Thus, it's very important to limit or eliminate commissions after the term. In truth, most new managers will take a reduced or even no commission on earnings that another manager is commissioning. But they're only going to do this for, say, the first album or the first tour, and they'll only do it if you're pretty successful. If they can't start making money relatively soon, managing you isn't going to be worth their time. So, while you can live with paying a prior manager something on after-term projects, you should limit it as much as possible. Key man. Another important aspect of your management deal is called a key man clause, hopefully soon to be called a key person clause. Although you have a relationship with a particular personal manager, your contract might be with their corporation or a partnership. Thus, it's possible that your person could leave the company, and since your deal isn't with that manager personally, you can't just get up and go with them. Accordingly, you could find yourself managed by a stranger, or someone you know but who smells like the Cuyahoga River. To prevent this, you should insert a clause that says the person with whom you have a relationship, the key person, must personally act as your manager, and if not, you can terminate the deal. If the company buys this concept, some bigger ones won't, It will only be for one of the owners of the company or a very senior manager, not the day-to-day people who stream in and out of the company's revolving door. If you do get this kind of clause, you can easily say that you can terminate if the key man dies or is disabled, and you can sometimes get the same right if he or she is no longer employed by the management company. Much trickier is the situation where they're alive and kicking, still employed by your manager, but taken off your account. It's much harder to say the key man must be actively involved in managing your life, because the manager worries that, even if the key man is working on your career, you'll try to use this clause to get out of your deal. You'll argue that the manager is doing a mediocre job, and thus is not actively involved, and therefore the management company is in breach of your contract. For exactly this reason, from your point of view, the broader you can make the language, the better. Double commissions. If, for tax planning or otherwise, you set up a corporation or other entity to conduct your entertainment activities, you want to be sure this doesn't trigger a double commission. Refer to Chapter 14 for a discussion of using a corporation in record deals, and Chapter 21 for corporations used by groups. Observe. Management contracts say that the manager's commission is based on your earnings at the corporate level. This is perfectly reasonable. Otherwise, you could easily pay the gross monies into the corporation, pay yourself only a small salary, and claim the manager only gets his or her commission on the small amount that comes out to you. For example, if your corporation gets $100,000 for your appearance at a show, but only pays you $10,000, it wouldn't be fair to pay the manager only 15% of the $10,000. However, it's not reasonable for the manager to take a second bite at the money. Once he or she has commissioned it at the corporate level, there should be no further commission when it comes out to you in the form of salary. In the previous example, this means the manager can't commission both the $100,000 and the $10,000. Most management contracts would technically allow the manager to do this double dip. After all, the salary is your gross income. But in practice, it isn't done by reputable managers. Still, it's a good idea to specifically say so. Power of attorney. Another provision to watch for is one that says the manager has a power of attorney, meaning the power to act for you, such as the right to sign your name to contracts, hire and fire your other representatives, approve use of your name and likeness, cash your checks, etc. I like to wipe out most of this nonsense. You should hire and fire your own representatives, and definitely cash your own checks. The only time I let a manager sign for an artist is if, A, the deal is for personal appearance engagements of no more than one or two nights, which will be performed within the next 4 to 6 weeks, B, you're unavailable to sign the agreement yourself, and C, the manager has your verbal approval of the deal. If it doesn't meet these criteria, bless the piece of paper with your autograph. As you get busier, you may want the manager to handle routine approval of the use of your name and likeness. If so, make sure it's only for certain uses. Publicity for your own career is okay, but major things like commercial endorsements are definitely not okay, and that they can only authorize use of a likeness that you previously approved. The best deals. Now that you've studied managers' contracts, you're ready for a well-kept secret. Shh, go close the door before I tell you. Okay, here's the secret. Many of the top managers have absolutely no written contracts with their artists. It's all done on a handshake, and the only discussion is the percentage. Their feeling, and I respect them for it, is that the relationship is more important than any piece of paper, and if the artist isn't happy, they're free to go at any time. Also implicit in this arrangement is that the artist needs the manager as much as, or more than, the manager needs the artist. Please don't misunderstand this point. Many legitimate and well-respected managers require written contracts, and there is nothing wrong with this. But there are also a number who fly naked without a written deal, and ironically, they are often the ones who keep their clients the longest. Even with these folks, I generally do an email outlining the terms. It spells out the percentages, states that the term can be ended by either party at any time, and deals with the post-term earnings. Refer to the earlier discussion in this chapter. It never hurts to make sure there are no misunderstandings. Picking the right manager. So how do you pick a manager? First, refer back to Chapter 2, which applies to picking everyone on your team. Then take a look at these specific tips. Let's start with the absolute best. This is the yardstick to use in measuring your candidates. The absolute best is a powerful, well-connected manager with one or more major clients who is wildly enthusiastic about you and willing to commit the time required for your career. If you're a superstar, you can easily find such a person. If you're not, this situation hardly ever exists. The reason is that, when a manager is powerful and successful, he or she is usually not interested in anything other than a major, money-earning client. The analysis is simple. It takes as much or more work to establish a new artist as it does to service an established artist, and guess which one pays better and sooner. Yes, every once in a while, a powerful manager gets genuinely revved up over a new artist. But this is rare, and you have to be extraordinarily lucky even to get such a person's attention. So let's look at more down-to-earth alternatives, not in any particular order. 1. A major manager with a young associate who is genuinely enthusiastic about you. 2. A mid-size manager who is wildly enthusiastic about you. 3. A major, powerful manager who is taking you on as a favor, either personal or professional, to somebody who is very important to him or her. 4. A young, inexperienced manager who is willing to kill for you. There are, of course, endless combinations of the aforementioned, but those are the major categories. Unless you can get the best possible situation described above, you'll have to make some kind of compromise. The compromise is between power and clout on one hand, and time and attention on the other. The reason a manager is powerful is that he or she has at least one major client who takes up most of the manager's time. This means you're going to get less of it, and thus less personal attention. Although these people can often do more in a 5-minute call than a newcomer can do in a week. At the other extreme, a young, bright manager with no other clients will lack clout and experience, but will spend all of his or her waking hours promoting your career. And in between lies a rainbow of choices. I personally like young managers a lot. If they're bright and motivated, I've seen their energy overcome the lack of experience and political clout with superb results. And to help you understand why, let me give you the Passman Treatise on Managers' Careers. Managers' careers go something like this. 1. The manager is young and enthusiastic and attaches himself or herself to a promising young act. 2. By doing whatever it takes, the manager promotes the artist into major stardom, at which point, A. Every other manager tries to steal the artist, B. The manager is offered 27 other acts to manage, and C. One of the larger management companies tries to buy all or a part of their company. 3. After a few years, the manager is exhausted from having worked so hard on the first act, back when he or she had nothing else to do and could literally live with the artist. So the manager wants to cash in on the fame and fortune while it lasts and accordingly starts hiring associates and taking on superstars. 4. This is the point at which many managers begin to lose it because they're too successful. Some of them have such huge egos that they won't take on associates of their own caliber for fear the associate might steal the artists. So they hire less capable people and give the artists lousy service. Others hire good people, but pay them so poorly that their employees get frustrated and go out on their own, usually stealing the artists in the process. As things unravel, the manager begins to lose artists who are no longer getting the personal attention they once did. 5. After these batterings, the manager decides it was a mistake to have tried to get so big, breaks up with his or her partners, keeps one or two key artists, and starts a record label or goes into the movie business. Of course, a few managers have been able to pull off large, successful management companies, but they're the exception. Also, most of these big companies are really just a collection of managers who essentially share expenses and some central services, such as marketing, digital, etc., meaning the managers are operating on their own, for the most part. At any rate, every major manager was a nobody at one time. While I don't suggest that a superstar take on an inexperienced manager, I do think many new artists are well advised to hire a bright, aggressive young manager. Obviously, you shouldn't do this if you have the opportunity to go with an established manager who is, or has someone in his or her organization who is, genuinely enthused about you. But if this isn't an option, the right young manager can be a real asset. Chapter 4. Business Managers. Role. The business manager is the person on your team who handles your money. He or she collects it, keeps track of it, pays your bills, makes sure you file your tax returns, oversees your investments, etc. Listen to me. Did you know that in California, a person needs no credentials whatsoever to be a business manager? Contrary to popular opinion, you don't have to be an accountant, much less a certified public accountant, and you don't even have to be licensed by the state. Technically, business managers who give certain kinds of investment advice need to be registered investment advisors, like stockbrokers, who are licensed by the federal government before they can sell securities to the public. However, very few are. What this means is that you could be turning your money over to someone who has no more financial training than you do. And when you stop to think about it, that's pretty scary. I know you wouldn't have gone into the music business if you wanted to be a financial whiz. If you were good with numbers, you'd be in some cubicle manipulating an electronic spreadsheet instead of winning your way into the hearts of millions. I also know that numbers make you nervous and may even intimidate you. On the other hand, there are parts of all of our lives that we don't like, and while we can get other people to deal with them day to day, we have to be sure we choose good people to do it. For this reason, I urge you to, personally, spend some time investigating all of the people on your team, and be especially careful when it comes to business managers. They can range anywhere from superb to sleazoid, with all variations in between. And their bedside manner and office space may tell you very little about what they're really like. The bad ones can be like a shiny used car that's rusting underneath a new paint job. Financial disasters can come from someone who's an out-and-out crook, or they can come from an honest person who is just a boob. My doctor once told me a story about an orderly he had when he was in the Army. One day the orderly decided to go that extra mile and do something on his own initiative. So with the best of intentions, he sterilized all of the thermometers by boiling them. So be extremely careful when you pick a business manager. Hopefully, I've now got your attention. So let's look at how to find the right person. Oh, and did I mention you should be careful? How to pick a business manager. References. The other professionals on your team can be a great help in choosing a business manager. But remember, they may have their own agendas. For example, a personal manager may have referred a lot of important clients to a business manager and therefore has a lot of control over the business manager. This is a two-edged sword. It means you may get a lot of attention from the business manager, but it also means that if you have a fight with your personal manager, the business manager is not necessarily on your side. If the business manager loses you, it's only one account. If they upset the personal manager, it could mean their whole career. This is particularly true when the business manager also does the personal manager's work. With reputable personal managers and reputable business managers, I have rarely found this to be a practical problem. But it's a sign to be extra careful. Family, friends, and hangers-on. Barring very unusual circumstances, inviting family members into your financial life is extremely dangerous. Most of them aren't qualified to do the job, and even when they are, it's difficult for them to be totally objective about you. It's the same reason that doctors won't operate on their immediate family, because they're too involved emotionally. And not only that, A, it's very difficult to fire your brother, and B, if something goes wrong, Mom may stop speaking to you. Friends are also dangerous, for exactly the same reasons. This is an area that really needs a professional. Business Manager Checklist. When interviewing business managers, refer back to Chapter 2 for general questions, then add these specifics. 1. What kind of financial reports are you going to get, and how often? You should get monthly reports. Ask to see samples of the reports. Are they clear? Can you understand them? 2. What is the business manager's investment philosophy? Will they only keep your money in conservative, short-term paper, meaning bank deposits or government notes of 30 days to 1 year duration, or in highly speculative pork belly futures? Don't settle for the gobbledygook that says, "We tailor our services to every individual's needs." Ask what they do for you and why. 3. Is he or she a CPA, Certified Public Accountant? Accountants who are certified have passed rigorous exams and at least have that part of the job down. Whether they have the other skills to be good business managers is a different question, but at least they're true professionals who have trained extensively and are required to follow the CPA's code of ethics. 4. How much do they charge? This will be discussed coming up. 5. What's the business manager going to do besides paying your bills and keeping track of your income? Will they do your tax returns? Some charge extra for tax returns or send them to outsiders who charge. Are they going to handle your investments or hire an outsider? In either case, are they paid for investments? Do they do projections, budgets, and forecasts of your income and expenses? Do they coordinate wills and estate planning, oversee buying and selling houses, monitor your insurance needs, oversee divorces? 6. Do they have a dedicated tax staff? As you get more successful, you're going to need specialized tax advice. For example, when you tour in the United States, you may have to file tax returns in every state you play, and international touring gets even more complicated tax-wise. 7. What security systems do they have in place to safeguard your money? How strictly do they screen their employees? What checks and balances keep a bookkeeper from turning up on a yacht in Venezuela, lighting cigars with your money? 8. Does the business manager want a written agreement? Most business managers require written agreements, although some don't. It isn't a bad idea, because it spells out exactly what's going on. However, don't ever agree to a deal that locks you into them for any period of time. You should be free to leave whenever you want. If there's a written agreement, be sure you see it in advance and have your lawyer look it over. 9. Does the business manager represent music clients? This may seem like a silly question, but some very talented business managers, even those who do film and television, have no expertise in the music industry, and you don't want one of them. The music industry is very specialized, and you need someone who understands its intricacies. For example, if they don't understand music publishing, they can't do a good job of making sure you're getting paid everything you're owed by the publisher. Good business managers know when something should have come in but didn't. Someone without industry expertise may not. 10. Have they handled people with your particular problems and challenges? If you're a new artist, you want to be sure they know how to watch every penny so you can survive. You also want to be sure they have time for you. If you're a superstar, you want to make sure they've handled, for example, mega tours, which require massive financial controls, as we'll discuss in Chapter 23, as well as knowledge of how much venues should be charging, what you should pay for a truck rental, how to minimize taxes, etc. 11. Do they have E&O, Errors and Omissions, insurance? E&O insurance pays you if the business manager mishandles your affairs. If they have insurance, how much do they carry? Also ask if their insurance only covers accounting, or does it also cover investing advice? 12. If you live outside the United States or plan any extensive touring or other activities outside the U.S., do they have international experience? I probably don't have to tell you that meshing the tax laws between several countries, much less understanding the tax laws in any one of them, is a major pain. And if you have, or think you'll have, these kinds of problems, you need someone who's been down that road. 13. Do they get referral fees from any place they might put your money, such as buying insurance, putting your money in a specific bank, running your investments through a particular stockbroker, etc.? A referral fee is an amount paid to the business manager for sending your business to a particular place, as compensation for referring you there. Ideally, they shouldn't get any such fee, because it could affect the advice they give you. They might be inclined to put your dough with someone who gives them a fee, even if it's not in your best interests. However, if the existence of the fee and the amount are fully disclosed up front, and if the business manager is willing to credit it against their fees, and if you get independent advice about the particular transaction, this could be okay. Maybe. Put your radar up if you see it. It's a serious red flag. 14. How do they handle check signing? It's now possible for artists to see and approve checks online through a secure system, so ask if the business manager has that capability. If not, you may want to sign the bigger checks. 15. Will the business manager object to your auditing them periodically? An audit means you send in an independent person to see if the business manager has properly handled your money. A lot of people are reluctant to audit their business managers. They think it's awkward because it looks like they don't trust them. In fact, the ethical business managers welcome it. They have nothing to hide, and they understand it gives you peace of mind to know everything is as it should be. You can figure out which ones don't want you to audit. Auditing a business manager is expensive, $25,000 plus, so it's not worth it unless you earn substantial monies. However, when you get to the big leagues, an audit is important to consider. If you raise the issue up front, there won't be any hassles later on. 16. Be sure the business manager wants to educate you, rather than just pat you on the head and say, "Trust me, kid." Most decisions can be condensed down to a fairly simple summary, and you should make all the significant decisions yourself. Be wary of someone who just wants to tell you what to do and seems offended if you question it. Fees. How you pay your business manager varies, depending on your circumstance. The custom is for them to work on either a percentage basis, 5%, an hourly rate, a flat fee, or a combination. Some people earn tons of dough and have uncomplicated lives. If this is you, go for an hourly rate or a set fee. Others earn much less and always seem to have financial troubles. If that's more your style, go for a percentage. Ironically, if your finances nosedive, you may need more of your business manager's time than when you're doing well. He or she has to keep the wolves away from the door and turn pennies into nickels. This, of course, comes at a time when you can least afford to pay. With percentage deals, a lot of business managers want a minimum fee, because they have legitimate costs to set up their systems for you. So, unless they're willing to take a flyer in the hope that you'll someday be hugely successful, they want their downside covered. These minimums are in the range of $2,000 to $5,000 a month, but can be much more for superstars. Sometimes the minimum fee is a discounted hourly rate, for example, 2/3 of their